Hello, and welcome to episode 217 of The Ethical Life, a weekly podcast that explores the intersection of ethics in modern life. I'm Scott Rada, a digital strategist with Lee Enterprises, and I am joined, as always, by Rick Kite, who is the head of the Ethics Institute at Viterbo University in La Crosse, Wisconsin. Hello, Rick.
Hi, Scott.
Today, we continue our occasional series inspired by Rick's lecture series called The Search for Meaning. In earlier episodes, we've talked about truth, goodness, and love, and how each shapes the way we live and find purpose. This week's topic feels different, but just as profound: beauty. We often think of beauty as something to look at or own, a photo, a product, a perfect image. But Rick, I think, will argue today that beauty isn't something we possess, it's rather something that happens to us. It can stop us in our tracks, lift us out of ourselves, and even reshape our sense of what really matters. So Rick, let's start there. What does beauty teach us about meaning, and what happens when we forget how to see it?
Beauty teaches us several things about meaning. Probably the most important is that to really find meaning in our lives, we have to get out of our own heads. We spend a lot of time in our own heads, preoccupied with things, with worries and concerns, what we're going to be doing the next day. And every once in a while, we're just stopped in our tracks when we come across something that's beautiful and it takes our breath away. What it reminds us is that there's something really significant out there in the world that we need to pay attention to. When we do that, we find our sense of who we are, like our significance, is restored to us when we are connected with something that's greater than ourselves.
As I mentioned, this is part of a series you're leading at your university called A Search for Meaning. And every other week, you invite the community into this lecture that you lead. And then after your lecture, there's a point where the people who are gathered at like tables of four or five get together and talk about some questions that you raise and I should tell folks that this most recent one about beauty was just last night. And I had a chance to go, and a lot of what we'll talk about today is going to be kind of based on what I heard not only from you, but from the people I talked to about this very topic at my table. And I'm trying to think of the way to go about this, but I guess I'll go about it this way. Because I'm trying to be, a good participant in this thing, as people were gathering and you were getting ready to talk, I quickly looked at the handout you gave, and I know how this works. I've been to these before. There are some discussion questions you park at the end of this piece. And one of them was, when is the last time you experienced beauty? So I'm trying to be a good participant here. And as people are filing in, I quickly think to myself when that last time was. I'll get to what I came up with here in a second, but there's an odd parallel in a way with the story you told, and I'll ask you to share here, about a recent experience of beauty you had just maybe in the past month when you and your wife were out camping. So why don't you share that, and then I'll bring it back to what came up when I was thinking about this topic too.
Okay, so and I'm writing about this for the column for this week too, this experience. So about a month ago, I was camping, end of summer, got up early in the morning, and just as the sun was rising, it was very foggy out. And I decided to take a walk on a nearby trail, started out, could barely see more than about 20 feet. But as I was walking this trail and going uphill through the woods, the fog started to lift a little bit. So by the time I got well up near the top of this hill, it was, I could see quite a ways because it was just wisp of fog like through the trees. And I found myself in this kind of forest glade where there was mature trees with a heavy canopy and very little underbrush. So you could see maybe 100 yards or so all around. And then the sun broke through the clouds and these sunbeams appeared coming down through the canopy. And there was like 20 or 30 distinct sunbeams all along this hillside and all around me. And this lasted maybe for 15 minutes or so. It was really remarkable. It wasn't the sort of thing that you could take a picture of because it was all around, and it was always changing slightly. You know, the quality of the light would change, and just as the sunbeams were starting to fade a bit, the two deer kind of trotted like through this glade and in and out of the sunbeams, and it was this amazing experience. And then as soon as the deer had passed through the glade, the fog completely lifted, the sunbeams were over. There was still sunlight coming through the trees, but it wasn't illuminated in the same way, right? And so that was it. And it reminded me of what Emerson says about so many experiences in our life that are evanescent. You can't really grasp them at the moment when you think they are permanent or they're fixed. They just kind of disappear.
But when you told that story last night, much like you did just now, you also added the detail that when you kind of came up this hill and found yourself in this moment, your first reaction kind of instinctively was
to grab my phone and take a picture of it. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then you found out.
I realized I didn't have my phone with me, and I couldn't have taken a picture of it anyway, mm-hmm. right? Because like the quality of it just was not capturable in that way.
And so here's where all comes back to what I was thinking about at the table just before you started your lecture. That morning, yesterday morning, and again, for good or for bad, in my first wake up, I'll often grab my phone and, you know, look through what's happened over the night, if anything new in the world. And it was on Facebook, and for anybody who uses Facebook knows that it's quite common these days that you'll see things that are, you know, recommended for you that have not friends of yours, but just things that show up in your feed. And somehow I saw something that somebody posted, some photos they had taken over the weekend in Dakota, Minnesota, which is just across the river from us. And some of it was in sort of what looked like sort of along the river, the Mississippi River. And then a lot of these photos were taken up at kind of in this area, in my opinion, a very underappreciated state park, a Minnesota state park called Great River Bluffs, which I bet you've been to. I thought to myself, and I looked at your question, what is the last time you experienced beauty? I thought to myself, you know, this morning I saw these amazingly beautiful photos, and it wasn't quite what you described, but it was not so different, where you had this, you know, very looked like peaceful area, this long, deeply developed forest, and this fog sort of, I think, lifting in the morning, and sort of this the interesting light that it created. And so I thought to myself, well, geez, this will be an interesting discussion for the table. If something you're looking at on a 4-inch screen that is on social media that I really did find beautiful, does that count, right? Is that something that's beauty? And then minutes later, you go on to tell this story of what you experienced, obviously, as the kids say, IRL in real life. It got me. But when you said there is no way to capture that, and no way, and you know, you kind of instinctively grabbed for your phone and it wasn't there, it was back at in your tent or your camper. And I thought to myself, well, two things. One, maybe it's too bad you didn't have that, and maybe I'll be curious your reaction. But two, your point in the lecture a little bit was that sometimes we should think less about trying to capture the moment and share the moment and just instead enjoy the moment. But in the telling of it just now and then last night, you are also sharing that moment as best you can. I mean, it's hard to paint that picture exactly, but I think you do it pretty well. So, one, do you think what I saw without seeing the photos, you have to just trust me, they were nice, does that count as experiencing beauty? And two, do you truly wish that there was no other way to capture it other than through words?
There's a couple things going on here. So one is you can certainly have beautiful photographs, but the beautiful photograph is a different thing than the experience that it's a photograph of.
Yeah, less immersive, certainly.
It's less immersive. There's no sounds. There's no tactile portion, you know, and it's smaller. So, right, all these things. but it can be a beautiful photograph, and you can take fairly ordinary settings and sometimes figure out a way of taking a photograph that turns into a really beautiful photograph. And you can also have photos of in a really beautiful natural setting that turn out to be really terrible. You get the lighting wrong, or you capture the wrong thing or something.
Or you have a bad camera.
Right. Or you have a bad camera. But so the photograph is one thing, and you can have, but the other thing is this, I think often when we look at a photograph of a beautiful scene, what we do is then we imagine what it is like to be immersed in that scene. And so when we say it's a beautiful photograph, what we're really saying is when we represent ourselves in that place, that seems to us to be beautiful. And it's the same thing as when somebody describes a scene and you picture it, right? You're not picturing, like when I tell the story, the people in the room weren't picturing the exact scene that I described, but something similar.
Or maybe something similar they had even experienced one time in their lives.
Right. And I think in a way we do the same thing when we see a photo, because you're seeing like a photo on about a 2x3 inch screen, and you're, you are interpreting that based on your own experience, what it would be like to see that in person. So I think there's many ways of, like, the experience of beauty is not a simple one. And I'm not saying it's always wrong to try to capture that. There's still something unpossessable, right, about the experience, that it's its own thing. And we would do well to remember that. And sometimes when we are so intent on capturing it with the photograph, we lose attention to the moment. And that's too bad, because I think it really does change our experience when, instead of observing what's around us, we are focused on looking at the screen.
You also mentioned, both in your column and you certainly touched on last night in your lecture, about how beauty demands reverence, that it reminds us what is most important often lies outside of ourselves. I think that's true. But the other thing that I think I can kind of tack on to that is, a lot of the examples that we're going to talk about today and that you talked about last night were, you know, being out in nature, for example, which we just talked about with this foggy scene you described very well. There is also a time in your lecture where you talk about this small still life painting of apples that caught your eye and made you kind of reframe where you were at that moment. And I think those are things we can all feel, most of us at least, comfortable talking about. I would imagine if I were in that, you know, came across that same scene in the forest, I would want to tell others about that and explain why it was such a wonderful moment. It seems, though, that we are either less comfortable, feel kind of weird maybe, about talking about beauty when it comes to people, because I think that that's okay. And maybe I'm not sure why that is, and maybe it is because of this reverence piece, right? Because it is, you can feel like reverent about this great creation that's around us, and these things that, like the deer happening to come across the scene at, you know, kind of this Hollywood like moment. And there's some reverence there, and I guess two things. Why is reverence so important, and does that also extend to the beauty that people possess as well?
I think it certainly does. Now, it's interesting when if you do a Google search for beauty, what comes up is people, and it's images, almost all of young women using products to enhance their beauty, and that's because, like there's so many so many companies trying to market beauty products.
Oh, and you go to stores and there's aisle upon aisle of that.
Right. And so I think initially, like the first thing that comes up for many people when we talk about beauty is kind of the beauty industry. And so in people and the way it's used to like enhance people's attractiveness. I think that's one thing that makes when we have a discussion of beauty of the sort that we're having, it makes it uncomfortable to talk about people, because it is so tied into the attractiveness industry and in sex appeal, mm-hmm. frankly, right? So that certainly we find beauty in people. We find it initially there's a kind of a physical attraction that some people will have from us that's quite superficial without getting to know them. One of the things I talked about last night is that there is different levels of beauty, and we really experience this with people where somebody that you might find physically attractive, as soon as you get to know them a little bit, you find out that there's something about their character that you really dislike, and they no longer appear as beautiful as they did before. And in others, you find that you learn that they're much more interesting, or that there's something about like the way they interact with others.
You talked about your grandmother.
My grandmother was not physically attractive at all. She had worked on farms pretty much her whole life, and so by the time I knew her, she was old and full of wrinkles and stooped over. As I got older and learned to appreciate more her character, she came to just be beautiful to me in many respects. And I would sometimes just watch her as she would work in the kitchen or work in her garden, and think like there was this kind of grace to her movements, to her actions that it was, I would say, just mesmerizing. So I think this often happens with people. We don't get it though when we have such an image-based culture right now, and we're so much online, you don't get beyond the superficial with much of the stuff that's online, right? But you get it in interpersonal interaction.
You talked about in your lecture last night, and I think a few people brought this up in the discussion section too, is my recollection. When you describe beauty as something that is something that takes us out of ourselves, and in your column, I think you mentioned Iris Murdoch and her idea of unselfing. And I think, at least my read on this, is this might be the most important part of why beauty matters, right?
Yeah. So Iris Murdoch regards a kind of beauty as really preparation for the moral life. Because of this, we are naturally drawn to it. It's very experiential. But it's the only kind of instinctive response to something that takes us out of ourselves, that gives us practice at unselfing. And this unselfing, as she describes it, this paying attention to something that's important, that's completely outside of ourselves, independent of our interests, is the basis of the moral life. That's the basis for like taking an interest in the well-being of other people. For example, you have to get over yourself in order to do that.
And you know, I keep going back to last night, but there were just so many points that were touched on that I thought would fit in well today. After your presentation, there were all these small groups talking, and the group that was about the furthest from us in the room brought up a topic that we touched on our table as well. And it really goes back to all the things you talked about with Emerson, and about how, and he really talked a lot about beauty in the physical world. And I'm sure would have loved to have been with you. And I'm sure you would have loved to have him with you on that foggy morning a month ago. But one thing that struck me, and apparently at least struck one other group in that room last night, was that so much of what he talks about, and frankly what you talked about, was things we see. And I thought to myself, and maybe a lot of people would say this, I don't really think I know anybody who's like blind or has a significant visual impairment. But I thought to myself, if they were in this room now and listening to this, and again, we'll just, for this scenario, say they weren't blind last week or last month, that they've been blind their whole lives, they might really have a hard time, well, they would have a hard time understanding a lot of what's being said. But at the same time, I think they might understand what beauty is, even though they can't see the world like you and I do. And I know that kind of came up in the other group, brought up in kind of the closing part of the large group discussion last night. And I just wanted you to kind of talk about that a little more.
Yeah. So I the examples that I used last night were visual examples. And I relied quite a bit on Emerson's essays on beauty, and that's what he talks about pretty much exclusively.
And mostly natural beauty, right?
Natural beauty, yeah. which tends to be what I would say most classical authors in talking about beauty talk mostly about natural beauty, and then beauty in art, mostly as representations of natural scenes.
Mm-hmm.
That's interesting that there's that preference for the visual, but certainly there's the beautiful in music, and there's plenty of people that talk about that and beauty of natural sounds. I think oftentimes when we talk about the immersive experience of being outdoors, a lot of it has to do with auditory experiences that for many of us who aren't really attuned to that sense as our primary sense, remains at the subconscious level, but still is really important of what we call the immersive experience. I think it's just because for most of us, our eyes are our primary sense, and maybe ears and hearing, that's our secondary sense. I find it hard as somebody who isn't really trained in classical music. I have kind of a passing familiarity, but I find it hard to follow in-depth discussions when people talk about music who are really into it. And
jazz for me is much that way. I mean, I know jazz has deep and profound structures, but to someone like me, it's just, you know, I mean, I don't dislike it, but I don't understand it.
Yeah. And I think, so that's something that you can learn to experience more deeply. Like as you become more familiar with it, as you pay attention to those structures. Same thing, like walking through a woods when there's a lot of birds singing. If you can't identify the sounds of the different birds, it just sounds like a bunch of warbling or something. But once you identify the different sounds, it comes to have these layers and depth and complexity to it that you couldn't recognize before knowing the sounds of these different birds. And so there's a training in beauty, right? A training in the appreciation. We used to have courses called art appreciation, mm-hmm. for example. It was really like, how do you know what to look for? And music appreciation is how do you know what to listen to so that you appreciate it more? But I find the same thing in natural settings. It applies visually also. I remember this great story that Calvin DeWitt, who was a really well-known teacher of ecology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, told the story of having a class in which they were looking at all the native plants and identifying them. And one of his students had gone away for the weekend. She came back and said she was almost in an accident because she was driving down the road recognizing all of these plants, and she had just driven past them, oblivious before, thinking of them as a bunch of weeds in the ditch. And now she's recognizing each individual one, and she was so drawn to it, she almost drove into the ditch, right? So there's our capacity for recognizing certain features enhances our appreciation of beauty.
Now, each of these weeks that we're focusing on this and that you've been focusing on this, you pick a writer, philosopher, thinker that you kind of focus on. And I think I'm right that of the ones so far, Emerson is by far the most contemporary.
Right.
Yeah. And most of his writing, remind me, was it the early to mid 1800s?
Yes.
And I'm going to guess that it's not a coincidence that is when, well, our country and many countries around the world were for the first time choosing or sometimes being born into places that aren't surrounded by natural beauty. You know, if you go back, I mean, there were cities in the 1500s, but like they were different than they certainly were even in the 1800s and certainly today. And it just seems like as the Industrial Revolution was starting to spin up and you had these factories that were starting to happen and more people were moving into more compact areas, I can't imagine it's a coincidence that that's when he and probably others really started focusing on the natural world, because in many cases, people's connection to the natural world was slipping. Is that mostly right?
Yeah. I would say prior to Emerson, it was pretty common for people to talk about nature as something that had to be conquered and as a threat. And it's a place of wildness, but also danger. And
which in some cases it was.
Absolutely. And so Emerson's first published collection of essays was titled Nature. Like, that really is the theme. And Beauty, I think, was the second essay within that collection. He's really focusing on intentionally talking about something that we're really naming because we're changing our relationship to it. And he was instrumental in kind of claiming the relationship with nature as being an essential part of the American cultural experience. And so then you get people like John Muir, mm-hmm. who becomes like a champion, one of the early conservationists. Yeah, but he was a young man when Emerson was an old man.
Okay. So
he was out in California, I think working in sawmills or something like that, when Emerson did a Western tour delivering lectures. Emerson was kind of a Taylor Swift type of figure. Like he
had his nature era.
He had these eras, but he would go on lecture tours and people would just pack these town halls, like the biggest building that they would have, they would pack it for him to read one of his essays. And so he did this Western tour out in California and John Muir sought him out because he wanted to show him that area in California around Yosemite and these giant redwoods. He wanted to show him these trees. And so they had some really interesting conversations. I think, though, like it's an interesting encounter because for Muir, Emerson showed him like something about how to write about nature. And to raise it up as a priority and something that had to be preserve some spaces,
which was probably not something people did think about 100 years earlier.
No, because then it's Muir's interaction with Theodore Roosevelt that ends up creating the national parks.
Oh, there you
right.
Go.
So like there is a real direct connection between Emerson and the fact that America preserves these vast natural places. And there was a lot of talk about how this is essential to our national character. Unlike Europe, which has these great museums and great cathedrals and architectures, like our cathedral is Yosemite. Like that was how Muir talked about it. And he learns to talk about that from Emerson.
As we close here, and this was kind of where you closed your talk last night, and maybe it's the place where I told someone at the table that I said, I may disagree with you a little bit. And
has that ever happened before?
It has.
Yeah.
And I'll paraphrase this a bit. If I get something wrong, please let me know. But I think what you said is that if you do this the right way, and that if you take yourself out of ourselves and sort of be immersed in the world around us, and that if you do this all right, that at some point you start to notice beauty everywhere you look, and that it does, and that, yeah, you'll still appreciate the foggy morning in the forest, but then you'll also start to see it many other places that you may not have otherwise seen. And I think you were saying that this was like a good thing.
Yeah.
What I said to those at my table afterward is that it's sort of analogous to spending every night of your life in a 5-star hotel with rooms, you know, free room service and the best view in the city. And if you do that twice, two nights in your life, you really appreciate that. If you're waking up 365 days a year, you sort of get used to it. Is that a danger with this? I mean, to me, it could be, right? Is that if you truly see beauty everywhere, then do you see beauty anywhere?
This is something that Emerson insists on. And I was there's a kind of training in the perception of beauty, and that these beautiful moments that come to us, that take us out of ourselves, help us. They train us. We have them, and they teach us that what is happening there at those moments when we're recognizing beauty. Because we also can be standing somewhere with somebody else where we're saying, like, this is amazing, and they're just saying, like, yeah, it's okay.
Can you go to the Grand Canyon, give it a 10-second look, and head back in the car?
Yeah. We have these different responses, and we come to realize, well, there's something about the very act of perception. There's something we're contributing to this experience. Can we have these moments more often if we learn to look in the right way or listen in the right way? It is not that all these different moments then just become ordinary. It's that everything around us becomes richer. And I don't think that devalues the mountaintop experiences. I think it just, what it does is it just makes the world more interesting. We start to look for beauty in different people and different aspects of them. We start to be better observers. We start to pay attention to what are the sounds that we're hearing, the interesting sounds walking through a city or walking through the woods. So it's a matter really of attentiveness. And I think becoming more attentive doesn't have a downside to it.
We end each show by tackling an ethical dilemma. And Rick, here is my real life question for you. A week ago, there was a neighborhood event that happens every year in a local school building. And it's just a few blocks from where we live. And I've never had kids in that school. I don't know the building well. The only time I'm ever in that building is in this sort of large multi-purpose room where the neighborhood group occasionally has events, and where I vote. So that's kind of my extent of knowledge in this building. But this building, I think, was built in the 1920s, and it's sort of reached the end of its life. And just recently, voters in our city of La Crosse, Wisconsin, passed a referendum where they're going to consolidate a couple of schools, and this old building is going to be the site of a new school. And I think very, very soon they're going to tear this building down and build a new, more modern elementary school on the site of this place. So we are in this building, and even 2 days after this neighborhood event, by the way, there was another public event there that was like, if you want to get one last look inside this building, this is your chance, which I'm sure for people who were more deeply connected to it, they would go. So here we are with this neighborhood group, and lining the back wall of this room are these 7 or 8 or 10 tables filled with just a wide variety of things, from office supplies to books to binders to you name it. And there were these big signs that said free, because I'm sure the school realizes, you know, anytime you have, and this is a pretty good sized building, anytime you're starting to clear it out, you open up a kind of a corner closet you forgot about, or a couple cupboards that you did, and you just find things that you don't really want to throw away. And the school, I think, rightly thinks these might have value to somebody. There's people coming in for this community group. There's people coming in for this kind of last goodbye to the building. Why not make these available so if people have a use for them, they should take them? So we got there a few minutes early, and I started going through this. And I tell you, I don't need many. Nobody needs as many 3-ring binders as they uncovered in this school. But I kept looking. The listeners here do not know this, but I have a new laptop bag that I brought
cool,
in today.
That I got it there.
Yeah, and there was a stack of them there, and I took one, and I didn't feel bad about that. But now I'll get to the dilemma after this long setup. There was probably 40 or 50 of these. They were also, I won't share on this show what logo is on the front of them, but there is a logo on the front, which leads me to believe these were a donation from a local.
And they look brand new.
They look brand new. I mean, I don't think, I'm trying to think if they were in a little plastic bag. I don't think so, but they look brand new. And would it have been wrong of me or someone else there to say, geez, these are nice. They probably haven't been used. I'm sure they have value to somebody. The school, clearly the last thing they want to do is throw them in a landfill. They're, I'm sure, happy I took one and I'm planning on using it. Would it have been wrong of me, though, to take that entire stack of 40 or 50 of them and put them on Facebook Marketplace or eBay and try to sell them for $10 a piece?
No.
And I take that, and if there's 50 of them, I sell them for $10 a piece. I believe that is $500.
Yeah.
And I can just take that money and not feel bad at all.
Yeah. Yeah. But here's why.
Yeah.
Right. They're taking something that they didn't have a use for. And instead of putting them all in a landfill, they want to say, like, these are still usable. They should get to people that can use them. What you're doing is taking them all and trying to sell them because you think, like, you could do that. You can make a profit. That's fine.
But they're presumably nobody's going to pay $10 for these things if they're not going to use them.
Right. Let me ask you this. Would you have paid $10 for the one that you've got?
Well, it's funny. Technically, I didn't pick it up. Travis picked two of these up. And he's like, because he thought his sister has a connection to the place the logo has on it. And he's like, oh, I'll just pick two. And, you know, it's funny. I never thought I needed it. But I thought, you know, when I come to this podcast, actually, I always stuck my laptop and a few other things to help us record to our podcast studio in my backpack. And I really like my backpack, but there were times when I kind of stored all those things in my backpack. And then whenever I needed to use my backpack, I had to like empty all that out, stick it on a shelf somewhere. And then, you know, so like, hey, this actually, I didn't know I needed it, but I'm actually like, hey, this is handy because now I can just use this bag for my laptop and podcasting gear, and I can use my backpack for whatever I want to use my backpack. So I'm not sure what your question was, but I think.
So, is there any difference between picking something up that you would have paid for?
Yeah.
And you're saying, yeah, it has value to me. I would have paid for it, but I get it for free.
Yeah.
Good deal.
And to answer your question, I didn't really know I needed it, but as soon as I thought about it, I'm like, yeah, had I thought about it, I probably would have paid $25, $30, $40 for this at like a store.
Yeah, this is just the way that we do it. We make it worth people's time to redistribute goods by the exchange of money. Because why would you take you wouldn't take 30 or 40 of it and spend all the time in trying to distribute to people that really wanted them for nothing, right? But you would do it if you can say make $10 on each one. And what you're doing is distributing it to people that could use them and keep goods in circulation. And this is why thrifting has become such a popular activity. We have people that are going around to different garage sales and different events, picking things up that they get at that they think they can resell, like in a thrift shop or on eBay or Facebook Marketplace, something like that. I think that's overall a good thing that we get a lot of things that stay in circulation, because the biggest problem we have in our society right now is we just throw too much usable stuff into a landfill and don't recirculate it.
And I mean, again, just to be clear, I did not do this. It never really occurred to me to do this. I think I've sold 5 things on eBay in my life. So this is nothing that I am trying to make a side hustle at doing.
I just want to add, I think there's a very good chance that if, say, they had 40 of those, that maybe 15 or 20 got picked up and the rest of them at the end of the day got thrown in.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure there's a date, you know, like when this, you know, on enter date here, whatever's left goes in the trash.
Yeah. So not only would it be okay for somebody to pick those up, I think they would have actually been doing a service. It would have been a good thing.
But I just can't help but think, and again, I did it, I wasn't going to do this and I wasn't going to be this guy, but I just can't help but think that at that neighborhood event, as everybody was getting up and leaving, if somebody would have pulled up their car and grabbed as many of those laptop bags as they could and made three or four trips, filled up the back of their car and drove home, there would have been a few people like, oh, that's, they would have kind of given that person, you know, been a little, some people might have been a little judgy, like, oh, you know, obviously he doesn't need 50 of those. So clearly he has a plan for them and it's probably not to give them to people in need. I think everything you say is right, but I think a lot of people's perception of that action would not have been as generous as what you just said.
Yeah, but I think that's just because they aren't putting it in perspective that without somebody doing that, they're probably going to go to waste, and that's even worse. And it also depends on the spirit with which somebody is doing something like that. If they're showing up first thing in the morning and trying to get every single one of them, and there's other people that would clearly like to pick one up, and they're saying, like, no, I got them first, right? That's the thing.
And there's like and there's eight people queued up behind you wanting to grab one.
There are also other kinds of exceptions. For example, when say a church is doing a clothing drive to get enough like boots and jackets and mittens and hats for children that might be cold that winter, and they ask people to donate, and then they're going to give them away free.
To the people in need.
To the people in need. If somebody then shows up and grabs a few of the nicest things because then they're going to resell them, yeah, that's clearly wrong because it's going against the very intent that people have when they donate in the first place, right?
And the only, and so I guess where I'll close on this, and I tend to agree with you, is that the keeping these things out of the landfill is a very good thing, and giving people something free that's useful is also like a good thing. And now that I think it through, my only regret here, or not regret, but maybe criticism, would be by the school district for maybe not being, maybe I missed something, it's possible, but maybe not being a little more promoting of these things and saying, hey, we're going to have this, all these things available, and we're going to have this room open some Saturday afternoon right before we tear this building down, that you can come in and to this room and grab anything off these tables, and here's kind of what's there. Like, in some ways I feel like they could have promoted that more, and even and not relying on a couple of small groups who happen. I'm sure it's for staff, right? I think there's some staff still in that building, and I'm sure they probably knew about it. But like, I almost wonder, seeing the amount of things that were there, if it was the school district's maybe responsibility to do even a better job of letting the community know about all these things that were on the free pile so they don't end up in the trash.
Yeah, and who knows how they, I didn't hear about it.
Yeah.
So I'm sure,
and
there's
a lot. You know what building I'm talking about, and it's not far from, I'm sure you drive past there all the time.
Yeah, yeah. It probably was promoted real heavily among employees
maybe
in the school district, right? And then the word gets out. And they're not really in the business of trying. Obviously, they aren't selling all of these things. They're giving them away.
And you don't think for a minute, though, that someone at the district should have thought, well, I mean, I guess I don't want to get too deep into this, but like, you know, you might think, well, if Fred comes in and takes those 50 laptop bags and sells them for $10 a piece and there's $500, could have the school use $500? But I suppose the tricky part is these were probably a donation by a group, and then selling it, like, if you're that entity, seems bad. So even if you're keeping the money, obviously, in your operational fund.
And it's not like the school district has a bunch of employees with a lot of extra time to do, like, the selling of other stuff, right?
Yeah.
But there are plenty of people that do have that kind of time. I mean, that's why I think that this is a good thing, and why generally the thrifting and the people that are making a little bit extra money on this, I think that's a good thing for our economy and for people that have the time to do it who enjoy doing it. It's generally a good thing. I appreciate going into thrift stores and browsing around and seeing what's in them. I like finding things once in a while for myself, but mostly I just like browsing through all the stuff that gives you a sense of what are all the products that have been made and bought and sold over time? And it's, you can see these generational trends, like in these thrift stores. It's just fascinating, all the artifacts that we are creating in our society.
As a reminder, the Ethical Life podcast is a production of Lee Enterprises. Please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts and be sure to check out Rick's column about ethics. And also, we will link to the YouTube channel that has Rick's Search for Meaning lecture series. And you can find all of that on the show notes, and you can find his column on all Lee newspaper websites. For Rick Kite, I am Scott Rada. Thanks for listening.
If you're a custodial supervisor at a local high school, you know that cleanliness is key and that the best place to get cleaning supplies is from Grainger. Grainger helps you stay fully stocked on the products you trust, from paper towels and disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Plus, you can rely on Grainger for easy reordering, so you never run out of what you need. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.